Beach easy.
I know that one other thing that meant a lot to me to work hard and to get through all this is my son. Because I remember my chief of police, when I told him about my tumor, he says, Davey's like, you got to be here for Chase, man. And obviously, positivity, prayer, not wanting to give up. But, you know, for your family, you know, you got to be here. And I had to be here for Chase. I got to be here to, you know, make sure he thrives and starts his own life.
Welcome to Life's a Beach and Then You Die. From personal growth and self-discovery to challenges and victories, we discuss it all. Join us as we dive into the extraordinary stories of ordinary people all the way to the end.
Welcome to this week's episode of Life's a Beach and Then You Die, where we hear the story of David Clowder. David grew up in Sharon Hill, a small town in Pennsylvania. His childhood was picturesque. He rode his bike around town and played with the neighborhood kids. His dad was a police officer and a role model. He was the kind of man that cared about his community and did his best to help everyone in it. Despite all of that, David's life wasn't perfect. There was conflict in the home. David's mother struggled with alcoholism, and even from a young age, he knew what was going on.
Like, I was more like a mama's boy. Like, she knew what I liked. She knew the kind of foods I liked and what she would cook for me would make me happy, you know.
So she was kind.
She was definitely kind. Yeah. She was happy when she wasn't drunk. I mean, when she was drunk, then she was a different person.
Was she mean? Or just,
she could be mean at times.
Yeah.
But I always had dreams, you know, if I dreamed about her being drunk, I would dream her as being like a monster or something like that.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
That was the way my mind went, you know.
Well, it makes sense though, doesn't it? Now that you're an adult and can look back.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
My heart just really bleeds for kids that have had to or have to deal with that because, you know, that's not your mom.
Yeah.
And you know she's going to get drunk and you know that that other person's coming, and that's a scary thing for kids.
Yeah, it's funny, like you say that, like it's two different people. It's like the Jekyll and Hyde syndrome. You know, when she's my mom and she's making spaghetti sauce and, you know, putting some aside for me and giving me a meatball before, you know, dinner and stuff like that. Like that kind of stuff is like, I love that part of my mom. But then the other part, it was just like, this is a different person. I know that feeling when my mom would drink, when when I would come home from school and my mom would be home if she didn't go to work or whatever, and she like had some cookies for us when we got home and she was fine. She wasn't drinking, stuff like that. I would know that, and I never had any feelings. But when I could tell when she had something to drink or started to get intoxicated, I had this feeling in my gut, and I could think of it today, which I don't get anymore. But, oh, God, I hated that feeling. That was, like, the worst feeling.
Was it, like, dread?
Oh, yeah.
That you feel in the gut?
Oh, man. I mean, I'm sure everybody's had it, but it's something that I don't ever want to have again.
Like most people who struggle with alcoholism, David's mother had a hard life that had led her to drinking. Her father had abused her in more ways than one. And she grew up with the responsibility of taking care of her siblings. But that didn't change the strain the drinking put on the family. David's dad did the best he could to work with her, even covering for her when she would get pulled over for drunk driving. But there was a moment when David's dad knew he had to leave.
We knew as kids, you know, when he would get home, he would put his gun up and on his dresser, and you knew not to go near it. And one time, I think that the final straw was when he saw his gun was moved by my mom. And at that point he thought, because she was so depressed and drinking, she could have killed herself with his gun, and then that would have been life and career and everything.
Yeah.
So he couldn't trust her at that point. So that trust was gone, and that was when he knew it was time for him to get out.
After his father left his mother, David was faced with a choice, who to live with. He ultimately decided to live with his mother. He felt it was his responsibility, that someone needed to take care of her. But it was not easy living with her.
She would drink. She was drinking and stuff. And it just got worse and worse and worse till I had to move out. But when I moved in with her, I still had that thing in my mind. I'm like, maybe I can get her to stop drinking, you know. And I would do little things. Like I used to buy her these little castles, these little knickknacks, and you're hoping, oh, maybe this is going to stop her from drinking. But and she didn't flaunt it in front of me or anything like that. You know, I'd see beer in the refrigerator. But she would drink at a bar, and she had a drinking buddy at one of the bars that she would go to. And then he started coming into the apartment, and then I decided it was time for me to move on.
So as part of your decision, did you just realize that showing her small acts of kindness and love wasn't going to help?
It wasn't, yeah.
Did you feel angry about that, or were you just kind of sad?
I was angry because I was like, she's choosing the alcohol over me.
Yeah.
At that point, it was just me, but she chose it over our whole family. But at that point, like I said, it was me that she was choosing it over, so it was time for me to move on.
His mother's drinking had a lasting effect on David. He found he had a hard time finding connection. He felt a distrust toward people who drank even just one beer. And he often felt an outsider because he didn't like drinking himself.
Oh, it was so tough to like date somebody. If I would go out, you know, with somebody and they would want to drink a beer or something like that, then automatically in my mind, they're an alcoholic. It's crazy how my mind was thinking.
Did you drink at all?
I would drink just to fit in or whatever, but I didn't like drinking. But I could still get away with just going to a bar and just drinking soda and stuff like that and still have a good time. It wasn't like I had to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, later on, I learned that having, you know, my mom as an alcoholic, that's in my genetics, you know, so I can't really do it. So, but when I would try to go out on dates, I remember a couple times vividly, like going to someone's house and not really snooping, but going in the refrigerator, you know, get something. And if I seen beer in there, I was like, oh my God, I can't date this person anymore.
Roadblock after roadblock, David finally admitted he was struggling and needed help learning to trust and connect with people. So David went to therapy.
I finally got into therapy to realize that just because someone's having a beer doesn't turn them into an alcoholic, or if they have a drink at a bar or whatever. So it took me a while, but therapy is what helped me get through that. I remember my counselor's name was Dick Oakey. I actually invited
Dick Oakey?
Dick Oakey, yeah. Uh-huh. Richard Oakey, yeah. I actually invited him to my wedding. Like, people are like, you're inviting your therapist to your wedding?
Well, that means like, he was a good one. I like that.
Yeah. So he helped me, you know, see through the stuff that I dealt with my mom. So when I met my first wife, my son's mom, when I met her, I remember the first date we went on. We went to Dave and Buster's in Philly. We were playing pool and she ordered a beer and stuff. And I remember that I didn't freak out because she had a beer. You know what I mean?
Right. There's some growth there.
Yeah.
So that's
good. I was like, okay, yeah. I could do this.
David had finally found connection and married his first wife, Jen. Together, they had a son and moved down to Myrtle Beach to be closer to Jen's family. It seemed like he had finally achieved the family life he wanted. Then Jen became a bartender, and their marriage began to struggle. They both realized that the lifestyles they had wanted were very different, so they got divorced.
Obviously, being by yourself, for me, has always been depressing, you know. Luckily, I had Chase, my son, on my days off, so he occupied a lot of that time, you know, because I was always doing stuff with him when I had him. We would go play mini golf. I would bring the arcades, you know, we would do stuff all the time. So yeah, I don't think I ever felt guilty for getting divorced. I felt bad because I was like mad in a way, because I was like, all right, I did all this stuff and moved down here because this is what you wanted to do. So there was a point, I thought about this, there was a point where it's like, well, should I move back up to Pennsylvania? But that was a no-brainer. I'm not moving away from my son. You know what I mean? Me and Jen had talked about that even though we would argue a little bit, is like, I'm going to have him on my days off and you're going to have him when I'm working. 50-50. You know what I mean? We're going to raise him together even though we're separated and we're apart. And to this day, you know, people come to me, like, I remember her family members when we would go to like his flag football games or whatever, people would come to visit her parents or family members. They would pull me aside and say, we really respect you for what you guys are doing and not arguing over stuff. You know what I mean? Because you always hear with divorces, oh God, this divorce is horrible and they're at each other and everything like that. But we were never like that. It was just like, we decided this was the best thing. And everything at that point was about Chase.
Right.
And I had said that to her. I said,
as it should be. Yeah.
I said, we're going to have to deal with each other for the rest of our lives because of Chase. So let's not be jerks to each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And I think she agreed to. But yeah, I mean, yeah, it's worked out.
That's great.
I think it all worked out for the best, even though at that time, like you said, divorce sucks. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This is not, it's not a good thing.
It's worth it, but it's horrible to go through.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
David would go on to have another marriage with a woman named Tammy that didn't work out. But he learned a lot and ultimately found the love and support he needs with his current wife, Gina. In Gina, he found connection, support, and true partnership in a life that they both wanted. We all have a home life and a work life. That's true for David as well. While he was figuring out his home and relationships, he had followed in his father's footsteps, attended the police academy, served as a part-time police officer, and then found himself working as a campus policeman at Coastal Carolina University in Conway, South Carolina, where he is able to make a positive impact.
I remember I had some students come to me. They were in a fraternity. They came to the police station to report this, and I was the next in line for the dispatcher to call me. So I went and brought him in, and we sat down, and they said, one of our fraternity brothers, we think he's stealing our books and selling them to the bookstore so he can get money because they were calling him a pillhead. So I said, all right. So, you know, I got all the information, and then I set up a plan in my mind what I wanted to do. So I called the kid in, I brought him in, and I said, I know this is rough, but your buddies, they said you're stealing their books and you're selling them. And I said, I got proof of it. I went to the bookstore. I saw that you sold the stuff back. So I'm going to give you two choices. I'm writing you a ticket no matter what. You're getting a couple tickets for larceny for stealing the books from your buddies. But you can either go to jail. I could bring you to jail right now. Or you can go over to counseling services. I know the people over in counseling services. I'll bring you over there. And you could go in, sit in there with them. And then when you're done, your tickets will be courtesy summons. So you can just show up at court. You don't have to worry about going to jail today. And when you're done with them, you make appointments, do whatever you have to do with them. He decided to take that route. So I walked him out to my car. He had been in contact with his mom and his girlfriend and stuff on the phone during this. So they showed up and they literally were there and they were like, what's happening? I said, I got to bring him over to the counseling services. You guys are welcome to follow me over there. So they followed me over. We all went in the lobby together. I had already given a heads up to the counselor. They were ready for him. As soon as he got there, they brought him to their office, closed the door. I sat up front with the mom and the girlfriend. I said, I had to do this, and these are the tickets that he's going to get. So you guys, you know, bring him home or whatever afterwards. Hopefully everything works out. So I left, and that was it. And we went to court. I don't know if the judge dropped or brought the charges down or whatever. But later on, I saw him at one of the football tailgates and he came up to me and thanked me. And that's the reason why I do what I do. And I just did it because that's how I was taught to do. You know, my dad taught me that kind of stuff. I didn't learn that in a police academy. You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, there's guys out there that'll just lock people up just because they don't think about that stuff. They just write a ticket and then bring them to jail.
Mm-hmm.
Where you can actually make a difference, you know, if you go that extra mile and say, okay, I'm going to get you some help or whatever. You know, I'll write you a ticket, but you can do it. And there's some people that won't get the help and they won't go that way.
Right.
So you can't save everybody, but you can give that opportunity as a police officer to make that, you know.
Yeah.
It's called police discretion. And we have that as police officers. And a lot of police officers don't realize that.
Everyone has to balance home life and work. But David had another significant stressor throughout everything. So while all these major life events were happening, David was struggling with medical issues and intense physical pain. It all started back when he was in his 20s.
So I was working at Wyeth Pharmaceuticals as a security guard. I was having pain in my leg, like sciatica pain. I'd sit at a guard check once in a while. It was sitting there, it would bother me. And I talked to a coworker and I said, man, what can I do about this pain? And he said, go get an MRI. And I didn't know what an MRI was. And he said, you have to ask your doctor for it. So I went to my primary doctor and I said, can I get an MRI for this pain, you know, in my back? And he said, I have a chiropractor in the office here. Let's do a little chiropractic work on it. So, you know, I had met the chiropractor and got some work done, but it didn't really help it out. It didn't relieve any of the pain or the problem. So I finally talked him into doing the MRI. So they sent me for the MRI. I didn't hear from them for the results. I literally had to call them up to get my results. Mm. And when I called, the nurse put me on hold and then got the doctor, and the doctor said, I need you to come right in right away. You have a tumor on your spine.
Oh, wow. So, and how old were you then?
I was 26.
Wow.
Obviously, I called my dad, and he was like, I'm coming with you to the doctor's appointment. So we went in. Doctor showed us the scan, and he said, I don't know what kind of tumor it is. You know, they have to do pathology on it and have to do a biopsy to find out what it is. So he sent me down to the hospital that's close by his office. And when I went there, I met the neurologist there, and they said, we're not equipped for this type of stuff at this hospital. You need to go to another hospital. And I found the hospital on my own down in Philly, in Center City, because Center City, Philadelphia, has tons of hospitals.
So yeah. You got your MRI, or you got your biopsy then?
So I got my biopsy down there. I found this doctor, Dr. Dante. He did the biopsy. And they were able to get enough of the biopsy that showed that it wasn't cancer.
Which was a relief.
But I still wanted to get it taken out because it was causing pain. So I went and had the surgery. After the surgery, I got a staph infection, went back in the hospital. So that stunk. But at that time, I thought everything was going to be all right. But the tumor grew back. So then I had to get radiation.
Didn't you tell me you almost died from that staph infection?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The staph 7 days in the hospital? And that was that scary for you?
Oh, yeah, that was crazy. Yeah. I mean, I thought laying in bed that, like, I was in heaven or whatever, because I didn't realize you could get that sick from a staph infection. And we don't know where it came from. But
probably
yeah.
just from the procedure in the hospital, yeah. right? That's yeah. fairly common. Yeah. Did you really think that you were dying? I mean, did you just...
Yeah,
because you felt so terrible, you just thought that was the end.
Yeah, and I heard voices that I thought I knew, and I would be hollering out to the nurses, "Hey, that's so and so, you know, have them come in or whatever." And I was like, "But
you weren't."
I was delirious.
Oh wow.
Yeah, we had an infectious disease doctor working on what was going on with me, and then when they figured out it was staph, so luckily I made it through that, got out.
But you thought. Maybe you were done dealing with that tumor.
Yeah. Mm. Yep. Went back to work, and then I started getting the pain again, and went back to the doctor, my surgeon, and he decided to bring my case to a board of radio neurologists to see what the next step would be, and they made a decision to try radiation treatments, as if it was like a cancerous tumor or any kind of tumor that you could do radiation on.
He tried radiation, but it didn't work, and he had to have surgery again. After having two surgeries in a row, David was done with all the doctor visits and tried to ignore the problem, but that only worked for a short time.
Going into 2000, I was living with my sister, I was working and just doing my own thing. And then me and my niece were playing basketball. She hit me in the arm. Either she hit me in the arm or the ball hit me in the arm. And I had this pain go down my hand. And it was like a shocking pain, and I was like, I better get this checked out, especially with the tumor on my back. I don't know if I put those two together, but I wanted to get it checked out because I'm a bit of a wuss, so if something hurts me, I'm not like a regular guy where it's like, I'm just going to suck it up. I'm like going to go check it out, you know what I mean? So I go to this doctor, it's a different neurologist, and they mentioned neurofibromatosis. He said, did you ever hear of neurofibromatosis? And I said, no. And he said, well, we're going to send you for an MRI of your whole spine. You're going to have a brain MRI. You're going to have a cervical MRI, thoracic MRI, and a lumbar MRI. So you're going to get all the MRIs so we could see what's going on in your spine.
The results of the MRI showed that David had schwannomatosis, a type of neurofibromatosis, and he had close to over 100 tumors in his body, ranging from small white dots to large tumors. The only treatment is surgery when the tumors are dangerous or extremely painful. But mostly, David relies on pain management. Though the pain is constant, there was a change in how he was feeling, which led to a new and scary experience.
When I got promoted to lieutenant in 2016, went to the night shift, then I started getting this pain in my eye, and it was a stabbing pain, like someone was jabbing me in the eye, like the worst migraine you could think of. So I didn't have a primary doctor, so I went to doctor's care, and my doctor there, he knew my history because I would go there, you know, and they had my history of stuff. They had a chart with me, and he said, I'm going to send you for MRIs, but he says, it could be this condition, but you got to get a primary doctor because you got to have somebody that can do these referrals.
After getting a primary doctor and seeing a neurologist, they were able to take a look at what was causing all of his pain.
So he had my scan from 2010 that I had on my brain that Dr. Plotkin had me get. We found that there was a tumor in my brain. It was on my left trigeminal nerve, but it was a dot. I should have been every year checking on it, but it was so small, we just were like, okay, it's nothing. So he had that MRI on one monitor, and then he had my new MRI on the other one, and you could obviously tell the difference. The tumor had blown up so much, it was pushing on my brainstem.
Oh, wow.
So when he saw that, and he was like, okay, well, it wasn't like he was going to send me over to Conway Hospital. He was like, all right, there's two places I have to decide. I'm going to send you to MUSC or I'm going to send you to Duke.
David got referred to MUSC in Charleston, South Carolina. They initially wanted to do radiation, but the tumor was too close to his brainstem. It seemed surgery was his only option, so he went to see a surgeon.
I went in, I saw him. First thing he said when he came in after he saw my scans, he said, if you don't do anything, it would be your undoing. I'll never forget those words. I knew at that point that even though I don't have cancer, I could die from this tumor. I said, should I go up to Philly to get the surgery? And that's crazy to say that to a doctor, you know, a brain surgeon. But I always hear that when I move down here that they don't have as good the hospitals down here. And he says, I could do your surgery. I do brain surgeries all the time. And then he said to me, go home. This was in December. He said, do you have any kids? I said, yeah, I have a son. Go have Christmas with your kids. We'll do it in the beginning of January. So drove home. At that time, I was married to Tammy, which that was one of the problems. She didn't go with me to the hospital. I mean, my appointment. So that was a rough thing.
Somebody, for brain surgery, yeah, for something
well,
like that.
Well, yeah, when you knew that I had a tumor in my brain.
Yeah.
But I called my dad, obviously cried. Told him about it, and then
did you feel? Why did you cry? I mean, was it more sad or scared?
Scared.
Were you more sad or were you more scared?
Yeah, I thought I was going to die. I thought that if I have brain surgery, I'm not going to be normal when I get back out. I might forget everything. I'll either die or I'll be a vegetable.
So you called your dad, and
I called my dad, cried with him a little bit. Then I called Chase's mom. You know, I told her. She said it's funny because her dad, Tom, he's a great guy. He was so mad that my ex-wife didn't go with me. He was like, I wish he would have called me because I would have went with him. You know what I mean? So, you know, I was that upset and went home. And then just started doing what I had to do to get ready for the surgery. You know, we had Christmas. And then
was it a special Christmas? I mean, did you write a letter to your son? I mean, did you do anything like that in case?
No, not really.
Just wanted to enjoy the holiday and...
Yeah. Certain things happened, though, that cheered me up. The first thing that happened was Tammy's brother, he called me up, and he gave me a good pep talk. He said that you need to stay positive. He said the power of positivity is there.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, it'll get you through it. Stay on that road. And I took his advice, and I thanked him for calling me, because he didn't have to call me. He you know, he cared about me. I was married to his sister, you know what I mean? He cared what was happening to me, and he gave me that great advice. Then I was going to get another follow-up MRI. I was in the MRI building over there on 21st, and this old man was sitting there, and he must have been eavesdropping on my conversation with the nurse because I was telling her what was going on. And when she walked away, he said, "Are you from Philadelphia?" "I'm from Philadelphia, you know." He said, "Can you come over here?" And I went over, and he said, "I want to pray with you." And he grabbed my hand, and he said he prayed that God would take the surgeon's hands and guide him in the surgery. Like, it took so much off of me, you know what I mean? It was like between that and Danny giving me the positivity, I was ready for the surgery. I'm going to knock this out of the park, you know. I told some people at work, I was on this committee for alcohol and other drug committee, and I brought it up in the meeting, and I said, "Have everybody just prays for me." And I said, "I'll get through this." So,
do you believe that those two things happened to you by sort of divine intervention?
Absolutely.
So you could, yeah.
Absolutely. God was there looking out for me. I mean, I always believe in God, but it made me closer to God. You know, with Gina, we go to church, you know, when I'm not working and stuff. I believe that if you stay positive and you pray about stuff, that things happen, you know, for a reason. So before the surgery, I got a little anxious, you know. It was a couple days before, I called Dr. Plotkin. Dr. Plotkin's not a surgeon, but he's the expert in this. And I had him on speakerphone with two of my coworkers. They were listening to the conversation. And he said, "If the doctor gets more than 20% of your tumor, you're going to be paralyzed on half your body."
Oh, wow.
So, you know, these guys heard that and they're like, "Why did he tell you that?" You know, and that put a little bit more nervousness in it. But I was still ready to go get the surgery. So we went, and I remember before the doctor brought me in, I was like, "Don't get more than 20% of the tumor." You know what I mean? And he says, "I got this. You know, you're going to be fine." So went and had the surgery. He saved my life. He got the whole tumor. Nothing's going to grow back. And the only side effect I had was my face is numb on the left side because I read the operative report, and he had to – he never caught a nerve that controlled, like, your muscle in your face, but he had to sacrifice some nerve branches to get that whole tumor out. But they weren't nerve branches that caused muscle nerves in your face or whatever. They're just facial nerves that, like, I'm, like, numb, but it doesn't really matter. It
doesn't bother you?
Yeah.
It's not noticeable to look at.
Yeah, it's just a weird feeling.
Yeah.
I mean, I go get my teeth cleaned and I don't feel it half, you know, the half.
Well,
the
see?
Half.
Bonus.
It's
silver
definitely
lining.
A bonus for certain stuff. Yeah.
But just amazing that we have surgeons that can do that and know
amazing.
Which nerves. And
he was in my brain.
Dang.
Like, he explained what he was going to do. He cut a little part of my skull out and went in there with whatever bionic stuff that they do.
Yeah.
And got that whole tumor out. It's just amazing. And then closed me up and, you know.
Is it, so do you still get it checked every year to make sure?
Yeah, so
it's
now with
gone?
Him, I'm like attached to the hip with him, so I have to see him every year. I get a brain MRI and a lumbar MRI to look at my first tumor. So I see him every year. So,
do you remember waking up from that surgery, how you were feeling, what you were
it's
asking?
It's funny because those guys were giving me a hard time because I was like, "I don't want anybody around" or whatever. And my buddy that came there, from, you know, that was working with me, he was supposed to keep everybody, you know, let everybody know what was going on. He gave me a hard time. He's like, "I just went home." He's like, "You didn't want me around" or whatever. But the first thing I remember is when I woke up is, you know, I wanted my wedding ring on. And I obviously wanted Chase. You know, Chase was there. And I gave him a big hug. And he came up to my bed and stuff like that.
Did you wiggle your toes and
yeah,
your
yeah,
fingers?
Yeah, I had to do all that stuff. Yeah.
Do you remember how you felt? Were you just like...
Yeah, I was like, I'm fine. I don't, you know...
We were like totally relieved because in your head, when you went under, there was a possibility you're going to wake up and not be able to use your legs.
Yeah. But like I said before that, I was positive that this was going to go good.
Yeah.
Even though I had that
the
little 20% thing that the doctor, I still was positive. And that's what got me through it. People that are negative about that kind of stuff, I don't think it goes as good. You know what I mean?
About anything.
Yeah.
Amen.
Yeah. I know that one other thing that meant a lot to me to work hard and to get through all this is my son. Because I remember my chief of police, when I told him about my tumor, he says, "Davey's like, you got to be here for Chase, man."
Yeah.
And obviously, positivity, prayer, not wanting to give up. But, you know, for your family, you know, you got to be here. And I had to be here for Chase. I got to be here to, you know, make sure he thrives and starts his own life.
David's current goal is to obtain a degree in finance and become a financial advisor. He wants to continue to do what he's always done, help others through hard times. He gives people hope and helps them know they are not alone in their struggles. He brings a positive outlook to life and values connection because that's what life is all about, loving each other and staying positive through it all. Despite the physical pain, David is here, a positive voice and a positive role model for his son as he goes through each day with a smile, doing the best he can.
If you've been inspired by this story or any others, please take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review.
We don't just get away at the beach, we get together. Because no matter what floats your boat, we're floating right along with you. With over 2,000 restaurants, live music all day and night, and endless attractions, Myrtle Beach was made for having fun and beaching easy. Welcome to 60 miles where you belong, the beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Plan your trip at visitmyrtlebeach.com.